Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody, along with my awesome co-host, Dr. Pettis Perry. Hey, Pettis, how are things in Bellingham, Washington today?
Hello, my friend. Thank you for that intro. They're going really well. You know, it's kind of interesting. Last night, I listened to friends playing music, and while doing so, I thought a lot about the community where I live and how we really support and help each other out of a sense of community. And then, ironically, this morning, I awoke, and I couldn't help but think about my concerns that unless we begin thinking about the whole of our nation, rather than focusing on the archaic notions of individualism and corporate profits at the expense of everything else, we're going to drive our nation into the ditch like so many other countries, including Russia, Chile, among others. So it's quite the contrast in thoughts.
Wow. Well, you know, music is soul food and community is soul food. So I can't think of a better goal. Pettis, will you do the honor of introducing our topic?
I would love to. Our program today is discussing Tom Hartman's newest book, The Hidden History of Neoliberalism, How Reaganism Gutted America and How to Restore Its Greatness. While the United States is at a crossroads regarding its economic future, many of us don't fully understand how we got here and why not neoliberalism began so prevalent in the U.S. And why is it time for us to turn our backs on it? Tom's book, The Hidden History of Neoliberalism, How Reaganism Gutted America and How to Restore It, Its Greatness, traces the history of neoliberalism to the present time and shows how neoliberalism applies a set of economic philosophies favoring free trade, financial austerity, and deregulation. This book explains how neoliberalism was sold as a cure for wars and the Great Depression. It outlines the impact that it has had on the United States, looking at different sectors, including healthcare, unemployment, and education. We have big things to do. Hey, Joe, why don't you go on and introduce our guest today?
Oh, it'd be my honor, Pettis. Our bold guest today is the brilliant Tom Hartman. Tom is a nationally and internationally progressive syndicated talk show host. Talkers Magazine named him America's number one most important progressive host and the host of one of the top 10 radio talk shows in the country every year for more than a decade. Tom is a four-time recipient of the Project Censored Award. He is also a New York Times bestselling author of more than 30 books that have been translated into multiple languages. Investigative reporter Greg Palast said of Tom's new book that it is a beautiful history of an ugly idea that greed is good and uncontrolled greed is better, even if it leads to mass misery. And on that note, Tom, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America.
Hi, Jill, and hi, Pettis. Good to be back with you both.
Well, thank you.
We are so delighted to have you return to our show. We're very excited to discuss this. I have four pages of questions, and I know we probably won't get through one page. But your newest book, The Hidden History of Neoliberalism, I understand is available coming this Tuesday, right, Tom?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think it is, this coming Tuesday. So to get started, why don't you begin with the basics? What is neoliberalism? When was this theory dreamed up? And why does this anti-liberal ideology have the word liberal in it?
Great question. Well, first of all, let's start at the end there. The word liberal means a very different thing in Europe. In continental Europe than it does here in the United States. On the continent of Europe, in England, the word can mean multiple things, so it's kind of confusing. But generally speaking, in Europe, the word liberal means what we would call libertarian or laissez-faire economics. It basically means hands-off, very little government, low taxes, all that stuff that you associate with neoliberalism or with conservative economics. And so, you know, neoliberalism was an idea that was come up with back in the 1940s by a group of economists, most from Europe. There was one American, Milton Friedman, of fairly high profile in the group. And they wanted to figure out a way to prevent the countries of Europe, the democracies of the world, from ever going down the road that Spain and Italy and Germany had done of flipping into fascism, or for that matter, going down the road that the Russia had done, you know, turning into the Soviet Union with communism. And they believed, being economists, that, you know, kind of like Abraham Maslow's old saying, you know, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. They believed that economics was the solution to everything. And so the core tenets of neoliberalism, the singular core tenet, is that the market is always smarter than government, that there are millions of decisions being made in the marketplace on any given moment. As we're speaking, there's probably, you know, millions of people all around the world who are deciding what brand of orange juice to buy, or what kind of blue jeans to wear, or what, you know, what color socks they want, or, you know, whatever. And there's so much data in the market that there's no way that a bureaucrat or a politician could sit around and second guess it, that the market is always going to have a wisdom that's impossible for individuals to capture. And therefore, we should simply basically turn our governance over to the market. Well, when you do that, you're basically saying, let's turn it over to the people who control the market, which would be the largest corporations and the richest people. And that's the effect of neoliberalism. The basic policies are radically reduced taxes on very rich people and corporations. The so-called free trade, the idea that countries should not protect their labor forces and therefore corporations should be able to travel the world looking for the cheapest labor they can find. It's like the famous old saying of Jack Welch when he was CEO of General Electric and was in the 90s and was starting to ship all their manufacturing over to China. He said, if I could just build a barge and move it from country to country wherever I could get cheap labor, that's what I would do. So that's, you know, number two. Deregulation. They have this idea that government should not protect the people. You know, if a company is selling food that's poisoned with arsenic, you know, eventually people are going to get cancer and start dying from it, and word will spread, and the market will correct itself. Or if somebody's selling if a car maker is selling a car that blows up or is, you know, badly engineered, again, people, you know, word will spread and companies will change their behavior. So therefore, the whole protective role of government in making sure that, you know, drugs are safe, that food is pure, that your water is drinkable, you know, for that matter, I mean, Milton Friedman, there's a whole chapter in his in one of his books about how we shouldn't even license doctors. The free market will take care of that. You know, some quack doctor is practicing, somebody who doesn't even have a medical degree. You know, after they've killed a few people, word will spread and people will stay away from them. And, you know, of course, it's a weird fantasy. I mean, this is an ideology that makes sense probably to a 16-year-old, but, you know, anybody who's lived in the real world gets it, that it's nuts. But these guys really believed it, and they started pushing it like crazy, and it was imposed on Chile in 1973 with General Pinochet. It was the first major experiment with neoliberalism. It took that country right straight into oligarchy and then essentially a neo-fascism. Then they tried it here in the United States with Ronald Reagan in 1981. We're still wrapping up that experiment, that failed 40-year experiment, which has reduced the American middle class from 65% of us to 45% of us. And they tried it in Russia in 1991, and that led to Vladimir Putin and oligarchs, because neoliberalism always produces oligarchy. It has here in the United States, it did in Chile. And we imposed it on Iraq. This was L. Paul Bremer and Paul Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld's big idea. And that's why they shut down all the government-owned businesses, which was about half the economy, fired everybody, fired the entire army, and told corporations all around the world, come on over to Iraq and just steal whatever you want. And no taxes, no tariffs, no nothing. Open borders. And, you know, it led to the looting of Iraq, of course. And now Iraq is basically a neo-fascist state. So that's, you know, there's a few other kind of peripheral theories and practices associated with neoliberalism, but that's the big stuff.
Well, I think you also said in your book that neoliberal evangelicals, it always leads to political violence, to widespread poverty and inequality.
It does, yeah. Because neoliberalism makes, you know, it initiates a massive transfer of wealth from working class and middle class people up to the top 1%. I mean, this is how we lost 20% of our middle class over the last 40 years. What happens is, you know, people start getting really seriously pissed off when they discover that, you know, they're having to use their credit cards to maintain a standard of living that just a decade earlier they could easily get with a single paycheck. And as people slide further and further behind, they start looking for villains. You know, who did this to me? And then you get the Donald Trumps of the world coming along going, oh, no, it was those brown people that came into the country over the southern border, or it was those black people who want your job or who want to take your place in college, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, victim blaming begins, and out of that comes political violence.
And you also, they also believed in deregulation, which is a button word for me after I read George Lakoff's book, The Little Blue Handbook, because he talked about reframing the word deregulation to say rules. And they're the rules to abide by. And we wouldn't play baseball without rules. We wouldn't play football without rules. We wouldn't play at capitalism without rules. So that's another one that people have fallen for, right, Tom? That just deregulate everything and it'll be fine.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my point about, you know, we shouldn't have any kind of protective regulations. Basically, the marketplace should deal with everything, and if something is going to be dealt with, it should be through lawsuits. So, you know, if you're poisoned, or if you're you know, a friend of yours or a family member is poisoned by a company and dies, then you sue the company. That's the solution. Government should not be imposing regulations,
well,
even licensing doctors.
We've seen how that's worked the 40 years. Pettis?
Yeah.
Thanks, Jill. Welcome back, Tom. It's really good talking with you again.
Thanks, Pettis.
I'd like to talk to you a little bit about laissez-faire capitalism and what that means. I understand the unregulated form of capitalism. I teach leadership, and there's a form of leadership called laissez-faire leadership, which actually is one of the most destructive forms of leadership because it's the absence of leadership. And so people can basically function any way that they can, and you find in those organizations that it's pretty destructive behavior. And in 2008 or 9, I remember listening to Greenspan and then later Bernanke, and they both said that their belief was that the markets would regulate themselves because it was in their best interest. Now, there was no basis of proof for that, but that was their underlying arguments for why deregulation was important. What are your thoughts about those perspectives and where we are today?
Yeah, you know, laissez-faire is French for, well, gee, I'm not sure what the exact translation is, but basically leave it alone, or you know, let it let it be, and you know, and it means don't try to regulate capitalism. You know, I'm guessing probably laissez-faire leadership is along the lines of, you know, let them learn from their mistakes. And the problem with that is that very often those mistakes can kill people, you know, or injure people very badly, or damage communities. So laissez-faire economics, you know, neoliberalism is really laissez-faire economics. The idea of laissez-faire economics has been around for a long time. Adam Smith kind of took it on in 1783, I think it was, when he published his book, A Theory of Moral Sentiments, which he always thought was a far more important book than Wealth of Nations, which was published in 1776. And, you know, he challenged it head on, that economies need to be regulated by governments because it's the fundamental question. Are we here to serve the economy, or is the economy here to serve us? What is, you know, why do we even have an economy? Do we have it so that we can all work our whole lives and just shovel money into it and some billionaire can end up with all the money? Or do we have an economy so that the maximum number of people can have the maximum benefit from the economic activity? And that latter answer, of course, is what FDR and LBJ with the Great Society and the New Deal were all about. And the former answer is what laissez-faire economics, libertarian economics, conservative economics, Reaganomics, trickle-down economics, neoliberalism, all essentially the same thing, what they say.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Tom Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program, heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM, weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman, weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
Today, our topic is the hidden history of neoliberalism, and we're speaking with the number one progressive talk show host and New York Times bestselling author, Tom Hartman. You may listen to his show weekdays on the Pacifica Radio Network, Sirius XM, and he has a live stream app, too. Learn more about visiting tomhartman.com, reach him on Twitter at tom_Hartman, and receive his daily takes by signing up for the free Hartman Report at hartmanreport.com. Tom, does interpreting, you know, I was thinking about originalism and how there's so many people focused on originalism and interpreting the Constitution with that belief system. Is that related at all to liberal ideology, illiberal ideology?
Or what we might call conservative or libertarian or neoliberal.
I was going to ask you if neoliberalism is similar to libertarianism, too.
Oh, yeah, there's a huge overlap. You know, basically, these things are all scams, Jill. You know, originalism is a lie. It's a scam. It's basically, you know, Scalia on the Supreme Court saying that he had the ability to channel dead founders. And, you know, I mean, that's basically what he was saying. I alone know what these people really intended when they wrote the Constitution. It's just a BS rationalization. It's not, there's no science to it. There's no, it's not even really particularly rational.
It's the hubris of it, too. Just
yeah, and phenomenal. That's why, you know, like Neil Gorsuch doesn't even talk about it. Instead, he talks about textualism. We have to understand it based on the actual words on the paper, which is just as bad because, of course, it's all up to his interpretation. But, you know, it's originalism is a scam and neoliberalism is a scam. And all of them are designed to increase the wealth and power of the top 1% and decrease the wealth and political power of everybody else.
Pettis?
Yeah, thanks, Jill. You know, we had a very robust economy at one point in this country. Can you talk to us about what that former version of ourselves was based on? I'm thinking of Hamilton's 11-step plan as an example. How did it work, and what was its impact on China or other countries that adopted that 11-step plan?
Yeah, there's a lot in there. Back at the founding of the Republic, George Washington, the British had required America not to manufacture things here. This, by the way, this is a British policy that wasn't just in place in 1776, it was in place in the 1950s, which is why Mahatma Gandhi's logo was a spinning wheel, because it was illegal to make cloth in India. You had to you'd pick the cotton in India and send it to England, and they would turn it into cloth and then ship it back down and sell it, and to keep the factories humming in the United Kingdom. Well, it was the same deal here and in the 1770s. And so after the Revolutionary War, George Washington wanted to be inaugurated or sworn into office in a suit made in America. And there was only one guy in the country making fine men's clothing at the time. His name was Daniel Hinsdale, and he lived in Connecticut. And Washington sent General Knox off to him with his measurements to get this suit, which is he was sworn in wearing an American-made brown suit. He wore British black for the famous painting, but that's not what he was sworn in on. So after that, Washington really got it, that, you know, it was time for America. If America was going to grow beyond just being an agricultural country, which is basically what we were at the time of the American Revolution, you know, farming and farming practices constituted the majority of the American economy, that it was going to take some kind of policy. The government was going to have to interfere in the marketplace, as it were. So he turned to his Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, and said, tell us how to do this. And Hamilton looked at what Henry VII had done, which was called the Tudor Plan. It was in the 1500s. And it had turned England from mud roads and thatched huts into a modern industrial power, you know, ultimately the East India Company and everything else. And so he just kind of cloned the Tudor Plan and did that here. And what it involved was protective tariffs, so that goods that are manufactured in the United States, if those same things are being manufactured overseas, there would be an import tax called a tariff on those goods, so that American manufacturers would have the upper hand. On exports, we would actually subsidize some exports to try to basically eat the lunch of our competitors in other countries. We would provide protections for inventions and things, you know, which actually got written into the Constitution, patents and copyrights and trademarks. And specific assistance to industries that we think are really important, particularly important to the national defense. And that policy built American industry, and it built America. And ultimately, arguably, built the middle class. Now, I would add to the building the middle class part that the resting state of capitalism, the normal state of capitalism, of unregulated capitalism, is what Charles Dickens wrote about in his, like, in you know, Christmas Carol. You know, where basically you've got the top 1% who don't even appear in that book. That would be like the royal family and the big landowners. And then below that, you've got a very small middle class, typically 2, 3, 4, 5% of the people. In the case of Christmas Carol, it was Scrooge and Marley. You know, this is a little two-person company, two employees, Scrooge and Bob Cratchit, a small business. And that was the middle class. The middle class was doctors and lawyers and merchants, you know, shopkeepers. And then below them, you had the 95% of the people who were the working poor, who basically lived in constant poverty and debt and fear of debt. And so, and that was the case in the United States. In 1900, Hamilton's industrial or American plan had built American industry and had built a lot of prosperity for America, lifted a lot of people out of poverty. But we were still a very poor country, at least the working class were. In the census of 1900, the average income, family income for an American family was $4,300 in today's dollars. Most Americans were very, very poor. Only 13% of Americans were even, you know, fully literate at that time. And so what Franklin Roosevelt did after the Republican Great Depression, or to lift us out of it, was he said, okay, you know, we want to have a middle class. And so we're going to change the rules of the game. We're going to put a 91% tax on income over $3 million a year in today's dollars. We're going to put a 50% tax on income over a certain level and from corporations. We're going to legalize, not just legalize labor unions, but make it very, very difficult for companies to punish people who want to unionize. We're going to provide a social safety net through Social Security, unemployment insurance, and a minimum wage. And all of those interferences in the marketplace, all of which, by the way, are opposed by neoliberalism, all those interferences in the marketplace is what took us from having a middle class in America that was around 10% of us in 1900 to 65% of us in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. Reagan, of course, then came in and doubled the tax on Social Security, changed how the formula was done so that, you know, people on Social Security over the last 40 years have been falling farther and farther behind. You used to be able to actually retire on Social Security. You can't any longer. George W. Bush in 2003 introduced Medicare Advantage to privatize Medicare. Medicare is now 50% privatized through that scam. And Reagan went after the labor unions and dropped the top income tax rate from 74%. LBJ had lowered it in 1967 from 91% to 74%, but he closed up so many loopholes it was actually a tax increase on the morbidly rich. But in any case, Reagan dropped it from 74% down to 25%, where it stayed for 1 year and then, you know, floated up to 27%, then 29%. But bottom line, that gutted the American middle class. That's why only 45% of us are in the middle class now rather than the 65% when Reagan came into office, is because neoliberalism is the antithesis of the New Deal, basically. Oh, and China. You asked about China, Pettis. So I was in China in 1988. I spent the month of November in Beijing. And that was the time that the Chinese leadership was debating how to lead China forward into the 21st century and out of the disastrous Cultural Revolution. Mao Zedong was dead, and it was like, okay, what do we do next? And there were basically two competing factions within the Chinese government. One was arguing that China should embrace neoliberalism, that this was a brilliant new idea. It hadn't worked out all that well in Chile, but it seemed to be working in the United States, and they should do that. And the other faction was saying, no, we should adopt the plan that originally made America rich, the American plan of Alexander Hamilton. And the faction that wanted to do what Hamilton did ultimately won out by 1991. And China embraced, rejected neoliberalism at the same time that Russia was adopting neoliberalism. And China is now next year they will be the wealthiest country in the world. Their middle class is larger than the entire population of the United States, just their middle class. And, they're doing gangbusters. Russia, meanwhile, has turned into a brutal, iron-fisted oligarchy. And which is what neoliberalism typically produces, and we've seen oligarchy here for most of the last 20 years, where basically very, very wealthy people and very rich corporations, play the tune to which government has to dance. Over the last 20 years, basically since the Gingrich revolt, which was a neoliberal revolt, there has been no consequential legislation passed that would benefit the average American. Everything has been done for the benefit of large corporations and the morbidly rich.
We are listening to be our bold guest, Tom Hartman, discussing his newest book, The Hidden History of Neoliberalism, How Reaganism Gutted America and How to Restore Its Greatness. If you'd like to be added to our news group, you may text Be Bold America to 22828. Text Be Bold America to 22828. And thank you to those who've done so already. It is so rewarding to see new people join our list. It just takes a second. We'll be back in 2 minutes right after the Hightower commentary on Clueless CEOs Confused by Workers Quitting. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
America's corporate chieftains have been moaning about the Great Resignation, the recent phenomena of workers just up and quitting their jobs. And now comes quiet quitting, workers who don't leave their jobs but only do what they're hired to do, quietly rejecting the endless extra unpaid tasks and weekend assignments that bosses try to pile on. What's at work in the heads of all these workers? Simple, barked one boss way back in 1894. Nobody wants to work. And here's an anti-New Deal baron in 1940 snorting that trouble is everybody is on relief or a pension. Nobody wants to work. Then in 52 came the same refrain. Everybody is, quote, too damn lazy and nobody wants to work anymore. Year after year, the exact same wail is repeated from on high, including this group gripe expressed in a corporate survey this year. 1 in 5 executive leaders agree that no one wants to work. Given the historic continuum of executive suite disdain for working stiffs, it's no surprise that the top dogs are blaming sluggish workers for today's rampant job dissatisfaction. But it's both hilarious and pathetic that high-dollar bosses are so inept at employee relations that they can't keep the rank and file on the job, much less happy. Their response has been to put a silly Band-Aid on this serious problem. They've created new executive positions like chief people officer, and hired consulting firms with such names as Woohoo and Happy Limited to come up with treats, trinkets, and gimmicks trying to make the workplace a playscape. Beer tastings, ping pong games, meditation, a Lizzo concert, company water bottles, wine Wednesdays. This is Jim Hightower saying, memo to CEOs, try decent pay and benefits, rational scheduling, meaningful goals, and personal respect. In a word, dignity. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with the brilliant Tom Hartman. Listen to his number one progressive talk show Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. right here on KSQD 90.7 FM. Visit TomHartman.com or reach him on at Twitter at Tom_Hartman and sign up to get his daily takes at HartmanReport.com. Our topic is the hidden history of neoliberalism, how Reaganism gutted America, and how to restore its greatness. And Tom, one thing that I wanted to maybe just spend a minute on, because neoliberalism, you mentioned that they just want to provide basic services like the military or protect people with police on their streets. And beyond that, they have no interest to provide any government efforts to improve the lives of the average citizen. And I wanted to make the point that that means no social safety nets. That means no Social Security, no Medicare, child care, whatever. And I wanted to share a story about my mom, because she was born in 1925, and not too long after she was born, her father passed away. And so her mother was a single mom in 1926, say. And another man took her in as his mistress, because there's no safety net. You know, there was no social safety net. So as a woman, you couldn't have a credit card or own anything. And so she needed a sponsor, and so became a mistress. Well, when he passed away, there was nobody left to take care of my grandmother or my mother, who was a teenager at the time. And she had to turn to prostitution. And my mother, again, this is because there's no safety net for a woman back then with a teenage daughter. And my mother ended up being raped multiple times by my grandmother's, for lack of a better word, pimp. So she was a very wounded person and didn't trust people, became agoraphobic later on in life, and could never even hug me, let alone say, I love you. And here's something that happened started in 1926 with no social safety net or any way to improve people's lives. And it still affects me today in 2022.
Yeah. Wow. What an amazing story, Jill.
So that's, I don't think people realize that neoliberalism means no safety, social safety nets for anyone. You are on your own.
Yeah, this was the first thing that Pinochet did when he took over Chile, was privatize the social security system.
Well, and there's such an effort here, too. I was going to ask you about Rick Scott's 11-point plan. Isn't that an end result of neoliberalism?
Yeah, it's a purely neoliberal plan. He wants Congress to be able to, every 5 years, to reevaluate every single welfare program in America. If Rick Scott's plan, which has, been embraced by the Republican Party, it is the only official Republican plan out there right now. Rick Scott is the chairman of the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee. He's in charge of getting new senators elected to the Senate. And his 11-point plan basically says that within 5 years, we will have ended Social Security and Medicare, among others. Medicaid, food stamps, housing supports, Pell Grants, you name it, he wants to end it. But, he's worth a couple $100 million. So from his point of view, let me cake.
And a Medicare thief, right?
Well, when he was CEO of his company, it was convicted of the largest Medicare fraud in the history of the United States. Right. He was personally not convicted, but
The company. Well, one of the best quotes. One of the great quotes from your book is when you said, "All of it is its fault and rhetoric about fiscal responsibility and conservative values was just a smokescreen to hide naked theft, racism, and misogyny." And even before Donald Trump, my dad, who's now 96, my dad told me many years ago, "The crooks have won," and that was before Trump.
Yeah.
You know, bringing in all the crooks beforehand. So it just seems that this four decades of neoliberalism has really set up that naked theft, racism, and misogyny.
Well, that was the essence of the Reagan Revolution, was, you know, taking power away from average working people and giving it back to the top 1%. There was actually a rationale behind that, too, which went beyond just neoliberalism. This started in 1951. I wrote about this in The Hidden History of American Oligarchy. In 1951, Russell Kirk published a book called The Conservative Mind. And this book had a huge impact on Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley and a number of the, you know, conservative intelligentsia, as it were. But it was largely panned by most of the conservative movement. Most of the conservative movement was just kind of nativist and, you know, afraid of communists and didn't want black people to have, or any minorities, you know, to have any kind of political power or wealth. That was basically conservative ideology at the time. But what Russell Kirk predicted, keep in mind, in 1951, we'd had almost two decades of the New Deal, and the American middle class was growing really rapidly. And, I mean, that was the year I was born. My father was just on the verge of getting into the middle class at that time. And so what happened was Russell Kirk said, if the middle class continues to grow at the rate it is right now, we're going to reach a point where people who do not have the intelligence or the class consciousness to really be in charge of things are going to have political power. And this will be a dangerous thing for the American Republic. And what you're going to see, Russell Kirk predicted, was if the middle class continues to grow at the rate it was in 1951, what you're going to see is that young people are going to start to defy their elders. Basically, all the classes and orders of society are going to disintegrate. Young people are going to start defying their elders. Women are going to demand independence and the ability to participate in the workplace. Keep in mind, in 1951, you know, women couldn't have credit, they couldn't have checking accounts, they couldn't buy a car, they couldn't sign a contract without their husband's signature or father's or brother's. There had to be a man's name. That was right up until 1973. And the young people will defy their elders, women will start demanding power, and minorities will forget their place, and they will start demanding an equal place at the table in America. And this will be a cultural disaster. This will be the end of America. And, you know, like I said, he was largely panned and people kind of ridiculed him. But then in 1961, the birth control pill was legalized. By 1965, you had the early beginnings of a women's movement. By the end of the 60s, you had young people in the streets burning their draft cards and saying, hell no, I'm not going to go to Vietnam. You had women burning their bras. 1972, the Supreme Court legalized contraception for unmarried people. 1973, the Supreme Court legalized abortion, and that really kicked off the women's movement. You know, give us an equal place in the workplace. And the civil rights movement was just, you know, rocking and rolling. And, you know, in 64 and 65, you had the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and then numerous other programs from the Great Society in 66, 67, 68, you know, from Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. And so at that point, Republicans, conservatives, started looking around going, holy cow, Russell Kirk was right. And so when Reagan came into office in 1981, his mandate from the thinkers, the serious minds in the Republican Party, his mandate was to reduce the American middle class from 65% of the American population. You know, they wanted young people going to college, but they wanted them to be frightened so that they wouldn't protest. So a great way to frighten them is to throw them into debt. They wanted working people to be able to have a job, but they didn't want them to have power in the working place, so they wanted to destroy unions. Reagan, of course, did both those things. He, you know, when he came into office, 80% of tuition was covered by state and federal governments. Today, it's only 20%. 80% is covered by tuition, individual tuition. When Reagan came into office, a third of America was unionized, which meant another third of America had the equivalent of a union job, because union jobs set local wage and benefit floors. So two-thirds of Americans were in the middle class, had the equivalent of a good union job. Now it's 6% in the private workforce that's unionized. And like I said earlier, we've seen the middle class slip now to below 45% of us. And so Reagan did exactly what he was supposed to do to save America from minorities, women, and young people run amok who were going to destroy our country.
Pettis, I can feel it on the cyber wire. You're wanting to ask a question. I can
Thanks
just
for
feel
reading
it.
My mind.
Yes.
There's just so much here to unpack.
I know.
Would you talk to us about how neoliberals use disasters and manufacture crises, because it's kind of what you're on the fringe of now, to really push their agendas?
Yeah, Naomi Klein wrote a book about this about a decade ago called The Shock Doctrine. And it was based on, you know, a statement that that Milton Friedman had made, that we probably won't be able to put our ideas into place, but we need to get the ideas out there, you know, spread widely enough that the next time there's a crisis, people will be looking for new ideas and they'll pick up our idea of neoliberalism. And that's exactly what happened. And she describes how neoliberalism was imposed on country after country as a result of crises in those countries. And she was absolutely right. She doesn't talk. I don't know that she uses the word neoliberalism a lot, because she went with that shock doctrine metaphor. But we're essentially saying the same thing, that this is these guys go around looking for opportunities, particularly down in Jackson, Mississippi. There's a company that wants to come in and privatize the water supply, just like they did in Flint, Michigan. And, you know, it's in fact, in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, there was a company called Aqua that was proposing to privatize both the water and the septic systems. When the good citizens of the county found out about it, they stopped it. But they were 2 days away from signing the contract. And, the first thing they were going to do is raise the average monthly water sewer bill from $44 a month to $88 a month. And then they would start cutting back on the services that they were offering, which is what happens whenever you see privatization. You know, you've got to pay $1 million CEOs and you've got to pay dividends to stockholders. You've got to show a profit. Whereas when government is doing something, it doesn't have that overhead. It doesn't have those imperatives. So generally speaking, for example, around the country, about half of the electric systems in this country have now been privatized. And dozens of studies over the years have found that privatized electric systems have poorer service and higher prices. And publicly owned electric systems, municipally owned or county owned or state owned, have higher quality of service, greater reliability, and lower costs. And it just makes sense, because they don't have to skim money off the top to give to fat cats. So, the shock doctrine.
The Texas experience.
Yeah, Texas is a great example. You know, like 95% of their entire electric generation in Texas now, I don't know if that's the exact number, but it's in that ballpark, is now in private hands. So, you know, they get whacked with some bad weather and, you know, suddenly people are getting $10,000 a month electric bills.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Want a friend to hear this interview with Tom Hartman? A free subscription to Be Bold America's podcast is available at Apple, Google, Radio Public, Spotify, and many more. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Join KSQD the second Sunday each month for Intersections, hosted by Seth Shapiro. Intersections takes you to the crossroads of ideas, mapping the contours of belief and knowledge through the stories and lives of influential voices. Meet notable people in diverse fields who are asking important questions. Their experiences and perspectives challenge us to pursue lives of meaning and purpose. Tune into Intersections this evening at 6, KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. KSQD, many voices, one station.
Today, our topic is the hidden history of neoliberalism, and we're speaking with the great Tom Hartmann, who is a New York Times bestselling and America's author and America's number one progressive talk show host. Check out his website at tomhartmann.com. Now, Tom, this week I was hearing you talk about something about, you know, our gun epidemic, and that we have in the U.S. 120 guns per 100 people in this country. The next country that has the second highest is Yemen, who's at war, and they have 56 guns per 100. And then back when Reagan took office, it was 30 guns per 100 people. So I wanted to ask you how you thought the neoliberalism ideology brought us this gun epidemic.
Well, neoliberalism argues that money does not corrupt politics. And Citizens United and the decisions that preceded it, Buckley and Bilotti in particular, in 76 and 78, these Supreme Court decisions that ruled that if billionaires or corporations want to, you know, shove money down the throats of politicians in exchange for those politicians voting their way, that's not corruption, that's not bribery, that's merely the exercise of First Amendment protected free speech. You know, that's kind of the core idea of it. And so, the practical, logical, eternal consequence of neoliberal policies is that you're going to have massive political corruption. And that's you know, basically what you're seeing here.
There's something that's going to be heading to the Supreme Court, Moore v. Harper, the case which some North Carolina legislators have asked the court to embrace the so-called independent state legislature theory. You know, and that theory, for those that don't know, is basically says that no office matters, even the state Supreme Court, only the state legislature does. And how is, or does it relate, how does independent state legislator theory also advance this neoliberalism theory?
Well, there's not a real connection between the two, okay, other than that it is neoliberal Republicans who are pushing the independent state theory. That theory is based on a clause in Article 2, as I recall, the Constitution, that says that the Electoral College, the votes in the Electoral College shall be determined by the state legislatures. Now, every state legislature in America has passed a law, which is what they meant. You know, the state legislature would pass a law defining how the Electoral College votes would be determined. And they've all passed laws saying that, you know, whoever votes, whoever gets the majority of the votes gets the Electoral College. There's two exceptions, Maine and Nebraska, and in both cases they just split the state in half, and you know, half goes one way and the other half can go the other way. But it's basically the same thing. But what these guys are arguing is that because the Constitution says that it's up to the state legislature, that therefore the state legislature should be able to simply, you know, pass a resolution or a law or whatever you want to call it, saying Donald Trump won. Essentially, you know, we don't care what the people voted for. And they want to expand it beyond that, of course, to in multiple ways. I mean, there's a bunch of different ways this can go that are pretty grim. But, yeah, that's what they're talking about, Joe.
Well, it's important for people to know that this is going to the Supreme Court. It's gotten that far.
Yeah.
And in my mind, it's a loaded gun to the heart of democracy, really.
I agree.
Yeah.
Completely.
Well, this is the time where we like to ask your ideas of what listeners could keep doing, stop doing, and start doing. You know, in your book, you highlight how America can go one of two ways, continue going down the road to neoliberal oligarchy as supported by the Republicans, or choose to return to FDR's Keynesian economics by raising taxes on the rich, reversing free trade, and creating a more pluralistic society that would rebuild the middle class. What can listeners keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to move this country back to Keynesian economics? It seems that our future depends on it.
Yeah, back in the 70s when the Supreme Court first ruled in a fairly limited way initially that political bribery was now legal, the Republican Party jumped in with both feet and a massive amount of corporate money. The Bilotti decision, which was actually written by Lewis Powell himself, Nixon put him on the court in 72. This 1978 decision allowed corporations to pour money in on a fairly unlimited basis into political campaigns, and that brought an enormous amount of fossil fuel money into the Reagan campaign and brought Reagan into the White House. And at the time, the Democratic Party really didn't have a problem with money. They were getting all their money from the big labor unions. And, you know, with a third of America being unionized, there was plenty of money to fund elections. So Reagan comes into office. So the Republicans are now completely sold out, completely embraced this idea. And but the Democrats hadn't yet. And Reagan comes into power and realizes that the unions are the thing that are funding the Democratic Party. And so he goes after them, destroying the labor unions. And by the time the 12 years of the Reagan and Bush administration are done and Bill Clinton's running for president in 92, we're down to about 10-12% unionization in the United States, and the unions could no longer fund presidential elections. So Clinton's looking around going, where can I find some money? And they decided, him and Al Fromm came up with this idea. They called it the New Democrats. And the idea was that they would take money from corporations, too. They would just do it from clean corporations, that the Democrats, if the Republicans were going to be in bed with, big oil and big coal and big steel and big chemical and big pharma, the dirty industries, that the Democrats would get in bed with the clean industries, with pharmaceuticals and banking and insurance and like that. And you could argue that it was a necessary thing at the time. Since about 2010, we've demonstrated that you can raise enough money to run a campaign without having to go to corporations or labor unions. And so what's happened is that both Clinton and Obama were still, embracing neoliberalism. But now you've got President Biden and a large chunk, I would argue the majority of the Democratic Party, the Congressional Progressive Caucus is the second largest caucus in Congress, have repudiated neoliberalism. And they want to go back to a system of actual democracy where the politicians do what the people want rather than what the fat cats want. And, there are still a bunch of neoliberal Democrats, Josh Gottheimer kind of leads their pack in the House of Representatives. And, they've all got their hands out. We just got rid of one here in Oregon, Kurt Schrader. He voted against, the bill to let the government negotiate prices, for example, because he was taking big bucks from the pharmaceutical industry. So, as the Democratic Party becomes less neoliberal and the Republican Party still is 100% neoliberal, I think it's really important to realize and do everything you can to support progressive Democrats who are willing to, fund their campaigns at the grassroots level and repudiate neoliberalism.
Well, and also, doesn't Senator Elizabeth Warren have a nationwide right to unionize act that we should be?
She does.
Yeah, calling
this last week.
People can support. Yeah, yeah. Tell us about that.
In 1935 we had the Wagner Act, also known as the National Labor Relations Act, which legalized unions and criminalized union busting. And then in 1947, the Republicans controlled Congress for a little brief 2-year period in the 40s, and Harry Truman was president. They passed this thing called Taft-Hartley, which allowed individual states to choose to go for what is referred to as the right to work for less. And what that means is that if the state governments, if the state legislature passes a law saying we're going to embrace Taft-Hartley and opt out of the Wagner Act, then many of the protections that law provides to unions and people who are trying to unionize just vanish. They just go away. Makes it very, very difficult to start a union, makes it very difficult to keep a union going in these right-to-work-for-less states. And so Elizabeth Warren has introduced legislation, and this has been something Democrats have been begging for since 1947, to basically repeal most of Taft-Hartley so that it is possible to easily start unions again. I mean, union busting is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and you know, it's a real struggle nowadays to form a union.
Well, and also neoliberalism has created such an inequality in income. And I think a while ago I heard you talk about on your show that two men own as much wealth as the bottom 50% of America.
Yeah.
And that money, isn't that money just sucked out of our economy and isn't available for churning anymore? I mean, one reason we can't have nice things like no potholes in the street is because so much money is held in too few hands. Am I right about that?
You're absolutely right about that, Jill. And, you know, it's stashed away in offshore accounts or it's you know, put into, you know, investments that that basically don't do anything, you know, I mean, like treasury bonds and things. And so it might as well not be in the economy. And that's why, you know, our economy grew like crazy from 1930 to 1980, as did the wealth of the average American. The middle class grew radically, dramatically during that 40-year period, 50-year period. And the, you know, and rich people got rich, too, during that period, although they were actually not getting as rich as fast as the middle class was getting wealthier. Since Reaganism, since 1981, since the introduction of neoliberalism, we've seen working people go backwards instead of forwards, sadly.
Oh, we could go on for another hour, I know.
Yes, we could.
I tell you, Tom, thank you for being our bold and impressive guest today. We appreciate you and all that you do. Thank you for writing another exceptional book in your Hidden History series and providing us with an hour of your valuable Sunday time. I don't know how you do it all, but I'm glad you do.
Well, thank you, Jill. Thank you, Bettis.
And, quite welcome.
You know, keep up the good work.
Thank you. It is so lovely to have you on the program again. What's up next on Be Bold America on Sunday, September 25th at 5 p.m., our topic will be the United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in a Post-Truth America. It's no secret that the goal of corporate-owned media is to increase the profit of the few, not to empower the many. As a result, people are increasingly immersed in an information system structured to reinforce their social biases and market to their buying preferences. Journalism's essential role has been drastically compromised, and repeated claims of fake news and the framing of the media as an enemy of the people have made a bad scenario worse. Don't miss United States of Distraction on Sunday, September 25th at 5 p.m. to hear Nolan Higdon from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Mickey Huff, president of Media Freedom Foundation. Both are with the nonprofit Project Censored. I also want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, and to our program director, Howard Feldstein, and again, to our bold and brilliant, impressive guest, Tom Hartman. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for Intersections. My name is Jill Cody.
And I'm Dr. Pettis Perry.
And thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.